Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. So stay tuned for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Starting at just $20, try Pure Faucet Filters today.
Oh,
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is brought to you here through the Pan-African Radio Network today, September 15th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from our studios in the city of Detroit. In today's program, we will feature the second part of an interview with Obi Egbuna, the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald. We'll be discussing the latest developments in Zimbabwe, as well as other issues. So stay tuned for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe, and today, September 15th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. As we mentioned earlier, we're going to be coming up with part two of our interview with Obi Egbuna, the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald. Also, in just a few minutes' time, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. So we want to, of course, encourage everyone to stay tuned to our program for this week. And Today, we're broadcasting live from our studios in the city of Detroit, and we want everyone to stay tuned to our program for this week. And this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In just a few minutes, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. So stay tuned for the Pan-African Newswire for this week.
Chimo kumbeni dike d'ailleurs les grands sorciers. Mamba Mubiayi, Mulubawadi Santa. Wawa Waka Yembe, Wena Menishi.
And this is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today, September 15th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And in just a few minutes' time, we're going to be reviewing some of our Pan-African Newswire reports for this week. We're going to be dealing with a number of issues involving political developments on the African continent. Anyone who is interested in logging on to the Pan-African Newswire, we'll give you information later on in the program on how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire on a daily basis. The Pan-African Newswire is an electronic press service that covers events all over Africa, throughout the African diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. So stay tuned for the Pan-African Journal for this week. And you're listening to Abayomi Ezekwe.
Souvenir n'engaye pas fêté. akati abulije ko bisugase arabiyo dokabana ngaina ye naruka mutuzo ko atya baenga injani ongo ngati kali korera katebe ongo ngati kali korera katoto e ansengi tuli bose ngana koringa se ansengi
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe here. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, September 15th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. And right now, we're going to come up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. In this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we're going to be dealing with the following stories. The landslide victory of President Robert Mugabe and the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party in the July 31st harmonized elections has posed a new problem for the United States government. Zimbabwe, which is rich in mineral resources, is still being subjected to Western sanctions against the Southern African state. The recently announced agreement over the purported existence of chemical weapons in Syria may lead to a pause in U.S. war threats against the Middle Eastern state. Africa, however, and its experience over the last decade has illustrated how internal conflicts can be resolved through regional organizations. The population of the African continent is scheduled to double by the middle of the 21st century. This is significant in light of the overall population decline among Europeans on their own continent and among whites in North America. And finally, the People's Republic of China is enhancing its partnership with the African media outlets throughout the continent. China is now Africa's largest trading partner, and this is causing consternation in the imperialist countries, mainly inside the United States. And those are going to be the stories we'll be examining in this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And according to the Globe and Mail out of Toronto, and of course, Jeffrey York, reporting for them out of Nairobi, Kenya, says that when one of South Africa's biggest newspaper chains was sold last month, an odd name was buried in the list of new owners, China's International Television Corporation. A major stake in a South African newspaper group might seem an unusual acquisition for Chinese state television. Now, this is according to a Canadian media outlet. It's nothing strange for Africans on the continent who have been enhancing their partnerships with the People's Republic of China and its institutions. And this article even goes on to say, but it was no mystery to anyone who has watched the rapid expansion of China's media empire across the African continent. From newspapers and magazines to satellite television and radio stations, China is investing heavily in African media. It's part of a long-term campaign to bolster Beijing's, quote, soft power, unquote. That's according to the Canadian journalist, not just through diplomacy, but also through foreign aid, business partnerships, scholarships, training programs, academic institutes, and the media. Its investments have allowed China to promote its own media agenda in Africa, using a formula of upbeat business and cultural stories and a differential pro-governmental tone, while ignoring, according to the Canadian media outlet, human rights issues and its backlash against China's own growing power in Africa. This formula is a familiar one used widely in China's domestic media. It leads to a tightly controlled pro-China message, according to journalists and ex-journalists at the Africa branch of CCTV, the Chinese state television monopoly that owns the China International Television, and launched a new headquarters in Nairobi, Kenya, just last year. Quote, it was our way or the highway, unquote, recalls a journalist who worked in Ethiopia for the CCTV. He said he was ordered to focus primarily on diplomatic negotiations over Sudan, with his bosses citing, quote, China's interest in the region, unquote, a reference to China's state oil companies and their heavy investments in Sudan. But what this article does not point out is that many of the Western media outlets that operate in Africa, for example, the BBC, CNN, and others, of course, focus heavily on the Western agenda, vis-a-vis the Western countries, as well as the African continent and other so-called underdeveloped regions of the world. So therefore, this poses a challenge to the Western dominance of the media on the African continent. And of course, this is posing a serious problem for CNN and even Al Jazeera, which has a strong pro-Western bias in regard to its news coverage, not only of the Middle East, but also areas throughout the world. This article goes on to say that if there is an information war, and they put information war in quotes, between China and the United States on an African battleground, as former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton suggested at a congressional committee hearing in 2011, it appears that China is beginning to win the war. And in other news, in terms of developments that have been taking place throughout the African continent, President Robert Mugabe's victory and the victory of the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party in the July 31st harmonized elections has undoubtedly precipitated and inflicted a landslide of serious fissures in the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme. President Mugabe, renowned for taking head-on the bullying superpower state and other hosts of the so-called first-world countries at international forums, such as the United Nations, masterminded a serious diplomatic coup in the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme, the KPCS. To date, the KPCS is divided into two, a pro- or anti-Mugabe and his gigantic diamond deposits at Maranje. Fundamentally, the decertification and recertification of diamond mining and companies operating in Maranje influenced the jurisprudence of the KPCS protocol. President Mugabe is viewed by many in the KPCS as a victim who victimized his perpetrators. At the core of these fissures is the issue of the proposed reformation of the KPCS statutes, especially the definition of so-called conflict diamonds, revenue transparency, human rights, and the maintenance of international best practice. The current fight is so huge, but Zimbabwe has become the de facto voice of weaker member states that are handicapped to oppose the neo-imperialist agenda of the United States of America and the European Union. In the past 5 years, President Mugabe nudged his Zimbabwe delegation to fight hard for Zimbabwe to be allowed to exercise its United Nations enshrined right to sovereignty of its natural resources inside the KPCS. The question is, will the newly appointed Mines and Mining Development Minister, Walter Chidhakwa, be able to lead from the front and defend Zimbabwe's voice? Does Minister Chidhakwa have the political edge to stand up to the shenanigans of the shrewd U.S. Department of Treasury and defend Zimbabwe's turf? How tough-talking will Comrade Walter Chidhakwa be? Did President Mugabe put him in the deep end? Comrade Chidhakwa has a corruption-free background and an impressive resume. Born in 1963, he did his primary and secondary education at Katuma and later obtained his master's in political economy in Sofia, Bulgaria, and another master's in international relations at the University of Zimbabwe. He worked in the Ministry of Finance, appointed chief executive officer of the Export Processing Zones Authority in 1996 to 2007. He was elected member of parliament in Vimba in 2008. He joined the liberation struggle in 1978. One of the main issues that have remained topical in the KPCS is the conduct of member states in ensuring that there is transparency in the deployment of diamond receipts. The marauding civil society of the KPCS has written reports pregnant with malicious and false allegations of diamond plundering by senior ZANU-PF leadership. It seems President Mugabe's decision to appoint Comrade Chidhakwa was strategic in that regard. It is apparent that Comrade Chidhakwa's work has been well cut out for him. As the head of the Zimbabwe KPCS delegation, he is expected to continue fighting attempts by Western member states to cause a defamation of the KPCS through reformation processes. The proposed reformation is simply a deliberate effort to recertify the Mbata Diamonds and Gen DMC, as well as the Maranje dependents and deposits. And in regard to this recently announced agreement between Russia and the United States over purported existence of the use of chemical weapons inside of the Middle Eastern nation of Syria. The African continent has much to instruct the world in regard to the resolution of internal conflicts utilizing regional organizations. Africa, of course, can boast about a number of conflicts that have, in fact, been resolved. It can lay claim to a rich history of negotiating its way out of all sorts of confrontations. So should the world be listening a little harder to Africa and its experiences as it ponders a way out of the Syria's desperate war? And that's according to a commentary published by the BBC World News. Some of its elder statements are arguing as much here. South Africa, of course, leads the pack in terms of its own extraordinary track record of negotiating its way out of apartheid, albeit with serious bloodshed. Last week, the BBC managed to spend a few minutes chatting with President Jacob Zuma about his vocal insistence that the same rules should now apply in Damascus. Having been in all three countries at the time and watched the derelict reaction of local civilians, the BBC says it can vouch for the popularity of these short, sharp missions. European history may teach the need to confront dictators, but South African history teaches the opposite, said Mr. Zuma. Quote, and we are right, absolutely, always, I ask always, unquote, he declared resolutely. And yet across Africa, the reality, of course, is much mixed. The negotiations have achieved plenty. An end to the longest war of all between South Sudan and Sudan immediately comes to mind. Then there's the Cameroon and Nigeria's dispute over Bakassi, which is the oil-rich peninsula between the two countries, Burundi, the internal conflict there, as well as a host of other conflicts on the African continent have been resolved through the intervention of the African Union and other regional organizations inside the continent of Africa. Today, South African troops are part of a robust new United Nations force in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is doing an excellent job to deal with more than simply facilitating a peace process. And with that, we're going to conclude this segment of the Pan-African Newswire for the Pan-African Journal this week. And in concluding this Pan-African Newswire segment, we'd like to recap the major stories in the Pan-African Newswire for this week. The landslide victory of President Robert Mugabe and the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party has posed new problems for the United States government. Zimbabwe, which is rich in mineral resources, including platinum, gold, and diamonds, is still being subjected to Western sanctions against this southern African state. The recently announced agreement over the purported existence of chemical weapons in the Syrian capital of Damascus may lead to a pause in U.S. war threats against the Middle Eastern state. Africa and its experiences, however, over the last decade has illustrated how internal conflicts can be resolved through the utilization of regional organizations. The population of the African continent is scheduled to double by the middle of the 21st century. This is significant in light of the overall population decline among Europeans on their continent and among whites in the North American continent. And finally, the People's Republic of China is enhancing its partnership with African media outlets throughout the continent. China is now Africa's largest trading partner, and this is causing considerable consternation in the imperialist states, mainly the United States of America. And we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, some 15 years ago, and has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, in magazines, in journals, in research reports, on blogs, as well as websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, it is a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day international media outlet. All you have to do is go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com, and in doing that, you will be able to log on to the Pan-African Journal and stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today, September 15th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And we like to encourage people to go to the Pan-African Radio Network website. And in doing that, you can, of course, log on to this program of the Pan-African Journal and also have access to the archives of the Pan-African Journal. And in doing that, you can, of course, have access to share all of these programs with other potential listeners. We're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
I'm gonna go
The voice of President Robert Mugabe giving his inaugural address in the aftermath of the landslide victory on the part of his government through the Zimbabwe African National Union, Patriotic Front. And of course, right now we have on the line Comrade Obi Egbuna, who is the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald, calling in from Washington, D.C. How are you doing today?
How you doing? You know what? You could just play that speech and I could hang up, man.
Well, we'll play more of it at a later date.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, this was posted on YouTube, the entire speech, and an excellent speech, and it shows the clarity and sharpness of the mind of President Robert Mugabe. Now, there was an interview, there was an article recently in the Zimbabwe Herald that indicated that the Obama administration, along with people inside Congress, are looking at ways of escalating the sanctions against Zimbabwe in the aftermath of the elections, than moving towards a normalization of relations. What is your response to that?
Well, what we didn't get a chance to talk about last week, and I'm so glad that we're back on today, is it actually started before the elections.
All right.
Two weeks before the elections, there was a meeting at the State Department about Zimbabwe's elections. And for those who don't know, a Japanese man, Donald Yamamoto, is now the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs. And he had a meeting about Zimbabwe, and they discussed a multitude of issues. And this Thursday, the Republican Congressman Christopher Smith, who is the chair of the International Relations Committee of Congress, they had a hearing about the elections in Zimbabwe. So it shows you that even though they knew that their candidate of choice, as President Obama said, his ally on the ground in Zimbabwe, Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, would not be able to deliver the goods, that they were going to use that as an excuse to escalate the sanctions. And basically, escalating the sanctions is returning to the posture that the Bush administration had, because ever since, for the last 3 years, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, the previous one, who I interviewed a couple of years ago, Charles Ray, said Zimbabwe was open for business. They had talked about an engagement process. As a matter of fact, you saw more engagement with Washington and Zimbabwe when the inclusive government was created. But those were their pro-Tsvangirai overtures coming to play. Because if you remember, from the 90s on, like from 1998 on, no United States representative of government went to Zimbabwe.
Right.
The tension starts with the Operation Sovereign Legitimacy campaign of Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Angola to prevent a reinvasion of the Congo and a reinstallation of Mobutuism in the Congo. And then, of course, on the heels of that is the land reclamation program. On the heels of that is the refusal by the Congressional Black Caucus to go and monitor the elections 11 years ago, because Zimbabwe's had three presidential elections this century so far. So
wow.
Donald Yamamoto, let's just give some background about him.
Go ahead.
He was, before he reached the top of the ladder at the State Department, he was the U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia from 2006 to 2009, the U.S. ambassador to Djibouti from 2000 to 2003, the Deputy Director for East African Affairs from 1998 to 2000, and he worked in Eritrea in the Charge d'Affaires office at the U.S. Embassy in Asmara in the Horn of Africa. And he's also a graduate of the National War College, just like Colin Powell, who,
wow,
when he was the Secretary of State, is the original person to put the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act into motion. So even though he's a Democrat, he looks at Zimbabwe the same way that Colin Powell did, the same way that Condoleezza Rice did, and the same way that Bush did. And when we talk about an inclusiveness, there's an inclusiveness on a strategy to isolate Zimbabwe and have a regime change. The Democrats are just as committed to regime change in Zimbabwe as the Republicans were. This is confirmed by the role that Donald Payne played in moving the sanctions through Congress. This is confirmed in the role that John Kerry played as being a co-sponsor of the Zadera Act, Hillary Clinton a co-sponsor of the Zadera Act, and Joe Biden a co-sponsor of the Zadera Act. But these are just some of the comments that Donald Yamamoto made in that hearing 2 weeks before the elections. He
wow.
said that Zimbabwe must decide whether it will support a credible electoral politics or continue to repress its people and isolate herself from the international community. And
well, that's very interesting.
Go ahead.
Considering the fact that this is weeks before the actual election.
2 weeks before.
Exactly. Now, what was the role of Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson, who visited Zimbabwe supposedly as unofficial envoys for the State Department? What was that about?
Well, let me just say, once again, you have a split. Jesse Jackson, if you remember, you had posted an article a few years ago. He had went Prime Minister Tsvangirai, when he was still Prime Minister, he tried to upstage President Mugabe's delegation at the UN 3 years ago. And what he had done is he had come to Washington on his own. They would not meet with him. Then he went to Chicago and met with Rahm Emanuel, because this was right around, this was 2 years ago, I'm sorry, this is right around the same time that President Obama and President Sarkozy of France they came to the UN for two reasons, to celebrate what they had done in Libya and to block Palestine from having UN status. You remember that. So
yeah.
At that juncture, they could not let Zimbabwe be on the center stage. So they would not meet. No one would meet with Tsvangirai in the high levels of government because they didn't want to put Zimbabwe front and center. So, and then 24 hours after that, all of a sudden, out the blue, Jesse Jackson shows up in President Mugabe's suite with Elsie Higginbotham, a businessman, the former U.S. Congressman and member of the Congressional Black Caucus, Mel Reynolds. And when we asked Reverend Jackson after his brief discussion with President Mugabe, we said, how do you feel about, do you feel that for an African in government to support the sanctions on Zimbabwe, do you feel that that is the equivalent of supporting UNITA in Angola at the height of the war there, or RENAMO in Mozambique at the height of the war there? And he said it's a play on words, and he said we just need the dialogue. But the interesting thing about that is there already was a dialogue. SADC engineered a dialogue between ZANU-PF and both factions of MDC, and Reverend Jackson was not part of that. In the case of Andrew Young, Andrew Young's has always been favorable to Zimbabwe. His role in Lancaster's on record. He's one of the first people to come out against the land reclamation program. And so the only challenge in regards to Andrew Young is I don't feel that he should have waited for John Kerry to deploy him to Zimbabwe. I think to call for the lifting of sanctions. I think that he should have done that on his own.
Yeah,
and I think that, I mean, and for him, he hadn't been to Zimbabwe in years. But when he did go, he went right after the land reclamation program started. If we go back and look, Andy went. And in terms of the political significance of his trip, I think it's a lot of things that people are looking at. On the ZANU-PF side of things, people are looking at the fact, when you look at Andy's portfolio, Andy can use his platform as a former mayor to get the National Conference of Black Mayors to develop sister city projects with Zimbabwe, or the World Conference of Black Mayors. Because of his role as a civil rights icon, he can get the Congressional Black Caucus to distance themselves from MD Tsvangirai and begin to reverse the trend because of the damage that they've caused with the sanctions. Because of his history with the National Council and churches, he can sit down with Desmond Tutu and tell him to never make a reckless statement again by saying that a military option in Zimbabwe should not be ruled out. So this gives him a chance. And from an investment standpoint, we know that the Corporate Council on Africa has a Zimbabwe working group that is financed by General Electric. And Ambassador Young, in 1994, Bill Clinton and Mandela named him the chair of the Southern African Enterprise Development Fund that they had set up. And because the U.S. private sector had functioned from the paradigm laid out by the White House, Congress, and Senate, that even though corporate businesses' political loyalty is to government, at certain times these corporations will tell the government to ease back, diplomatically speaking, or ease back, militarily speaking, because taking that type of posture is profitable. So because of that capacity, I think that that's why Zimbabwe was received Andrew Young in a warm manner. But with Jesse on the question of Zimbabwe, he's played both sides of defense.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, another name came up just this last past week in regard to some type of rationale for the continuing of sanctions against Zimbabwe, and that is Imani Countess. Could you explain who that is?
Oh, well, Imani Countess is works with TransAfrica, and Imani Countess in 2008, well, Imani Countess is married to a Zimbabwean.
Yes.
And he's pro MDC, he's pro Tsvangirai. She told me out of her own mouth that her husband was going to vote for Tsvangirai. And if people remember in 2008, her name appeared in the Washington Post because she had went on public record and said that a high-level official in Zimbabwe's government had told her they would do whatever they would to cling on to power. Now, this was published in the Washington Post, ironically. Now, the interesting, and it called Imani an observer to the elections. TransAfrica has never been invited to observe elections in Zimbabwe. They weren't invited in 2002. They weren't invited in 2005. They weren't invited in 2008. And they were not invited in 2013. And as a matter of fact, Imani Countess is one of, and when I asked her who the official was, because President Mugabe is very concerned about corruption inside his party, corruption inside his government. So if any high-level official felt that comfortable making such a reckless and detrimental statement to her, then she was obliged, if she's concerned about Zimbabwe's landscape, if she's concerned about Africa's landscape, she should have come forward with that. When I asked her who it was, she would not tell me. And it's almost in the same vein, Brother Abiyomi, that when the Washington Post correspondent to Southern Africa, Craig Timberg, back in 2008, claimed that he had an audio tape of President Mugabe, Vice President Joyce Mujuru, her late husband, General Solomon Mujuru, and other high-level members of ZANU-PF planning a campaign of violence against MDC, the Shangri faction of MDC. And he went on to say that he confirmed this because some members of the president's office spoke to him on the condition of anonymity. Now, you know, if he had that type of documentation, the Post would have not hesitated to use it. You know, yeah, that the White House, the Senate, and Congress would have come out and played that everywhere. They would have played it on CNN. They would have played it on C-SPAN. They would have given a copy to the Voice of America Studio 7 desk, the Voice of America Zimbabwe desk. So this is another example of just peddling falsehood. So I don't know what Imani Countess is up to now. I know TransAfrica has been relatively quiet because at the end of the day, I don't care who it is, whether it's Danny Glover, whether it's James Early, whether it's Harry Belafonte, whether it's Randall Robinson, who I wrote an open letter to that he didn't respond to. What TransAfrica needs to do is explain to the African community why they were why they set up a fund to peddle national endowment, smuggle National Endowment for Democracy funding to 14 civil society groups in Zimbabwe. What the hell is TransAfrica with their pedigree and their credentials doing in a bed with National Endowment for Democracy? We've heard of strange bedfellows, but those sheets got too much blood on them if you're committed to Africa to lay down with those pigs.
Yes, I agree. And I believe I met Imani Countess 13 years ago. At Wayne State University in Detroit, there was a organizing conference of the Black Radical Congress, which I was not a member of, but we did assist them. We were assisting them in putting on, we actually organized the conference. And it was the last, that was the only dealings I ever had with them and the last dealings I ever had with them because it was obvious to me where they were headed and where I was headed was in two opposite directions. They had one guy who was a top official at the time with the AFL-CIO who was anti-Zimbabwe. Bill Fletcher, that was his name.
No, my fault. I'm sorry. I always mix them up. Who was on his way to become the director of TransAfrica. And he's the one who wrote the statement, why I decided to oppose Zimbabwe.
Exactly. Go ahead.
And Bill Fletcher, I'm glad you brought him up. First of all, he canceled debates with me on four different occasions. I'm not going to call them debates because those have that has antagonistic overtones. Discussions, brother to brother. And as a matter of fact, Bill Fletcher, the way I met him was in 2000. I introduced him to the now late international representative of the American Indian Movement Grand Governing Council, Wabuyinini, also known as Vernon Belcourt. And Brother Wabuyinini wanted Danny Glover to come out and apologize for playing the role in the Buffalo Soldiers. And he wanted TransAfrica to have a sit-down with the Native Americans about the reparations question and the Zimbabwe question. And what had happened was Bill Fletcher had asked me, was I interested in a job that became available with Africa Action? Because we had some brainstorming around the issue of Cuba, and I told him that it would be a conflict of interest because Africa Action and TransAfrica were anti-Zimbabwe and anti-ZANU-PF, rather, and anti-President Mugabe, and I was not. And it's no way it would have been a conflict of interest. So I'll just deal with that. And then as time went on, we saw what happened. In Bill Fletcher's case, he was just a sucker for the sloganism, if you will, because him being a trade unionist, what they did, Abiyomi, that was very manipulative to our community in terms of defending their position. They would say, well, we're not with MDC. We're with the trade unions. But for people who know the history, you couldn't pull wool over our eyes. Shangri's Trade Union, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, is where the money was given. It was given to them to start MDC, and Shangri resigned from that trade union to start MDC. And it goes back to what we were talking about last week. If you know the history of Zimbabwe, trade unionism has always been used to sabotage the liberation movement. Because if you go back historically now, and this is what when we had this debate with Bill Lucy, who is another player in this soap opera, if you will, because Bill Lucy is on the NAACP's board, but he's also the organization that we have here, the union one. He's considered the dean of trade unionism. And yes. He tried to go to Zimbabwe, and they wouldn't let him in there. And they kept saying, we're aligned with the trade union. But the trade union were the ones that were working with the AFL-CIO's International Labor Solidarity Center, which has always been an instrument for the CIA, been an instrument from imperialism from its very inception. And if you go back further, I asked, and when Bill Lucy was on the NAACP's board, we believe he was one of the people that persuaded the NAACP not to publish their report on the 2002 elections. We believe he was very instrumental in that. And so one of the things we asked Bill Lucy was, well, Bill, when you talk about trade unionism in Zimbabwe and the workers' perspective, have you spoke to Joseph Masika? He didn't know who that was. This is the vice president of Zimbabwe, who's one of the most preeminent trade unionists in the history of the movement there, in the struggle. We asked him, did he ever talk to Simon Muzenda? He said, who's Simon Muzenda? Simon Muzenda was also one of the vice presidents of Zimbabwe, a preeminent trade unionist. We said, wow, did you ever talk to Joshua Nkomo, father Zimbabwe himself, another preeminent trade unionist? And when we take a look at Africa as a whole, labor unions have never been the driving force in the struggle in Africa. It's always been liberation movements. It's always been students, and it's always been women. That's no disregard to labor, but labor movements have always been aligned with imperialism in Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America, or shall I say, trade unions were the most vulnerable instruments on the ground that were part of the people's genuine resistance that imperialism could infiltrate. And that definitely was the case in Zimbabwe. And the last thing I'm going to say about that, it goes back to a guy named Ruben Jamila, who was trained by the AFL-CIO's Labor Solidarity Center and was trained by the CIA and was working in Uganda with because Tom Mboya had persuaded Milton Obote to create a training ground for trade unionists. And when Obote found out that was a CIA plot, he threw them out the country. And when Ruben Jamila, when it was discovered he was a CIA agent in Zimbabwe, he showed up at the funeral of Samuel Parinyatwa, the first African doctor in Zimbabwe and the co-founder of ZAPU. He was the vice president of ZAPU under Joshua Nkomo. And when the people saw Ruben Jamila's face, they started throwing stones at him. And you know what they were saying to him? They were saying, Shombe, 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 get out of here, Shombe. And for people who don't know, that are listening, that don't know what I'm talking about, they were calling him the equivalent of Mose Tshombe, who, along with Mobutu, assassinated Patrice Lumumba. So anybody in this country that tells you that they're with trade unions in Zimbabwe, you're working with the CIA, you're working with imperialism, and you're working against the wishes and the tide of the people and the tide of justice and the tide of history.
Yeah, I've noticed that even within the trade union movement itself in Zimbabwe, there's been enormous splits over the last several months. Now, going back to this BRC conference that was held in Detroit in 2000.
Yeah.
There was another woman there from African Action, along with Imani Kantas, and we had a big debate in one of the panels around Zimbabwe and the Democratic Republic of Congo and other issues.
Yeah.
And
I heard about it.
It was pretty heated. So anyway, I when I left, when the panel was over, you know, they still wanted to talk to me, these two African-American women. One of them, I guess it was Imani Kantas, told me she was married to a Zimbabwean, and it was obvious that he was with, you know, the opposition. And so I asked him point blank. I said, where do you get your funding? and they were very cagey about it. They would not answer me directly in regard to they get their funding. But these groups, we haven't heard hardly anything from them over the last several years. So
no.
Perhaps they're no longer useful.
Well, let me say this. There is light at the end of the tunnel. Because when our brother Roy Ajimong, who is brilliant documentary, Mugabe, Villain or Hero, was shown at the Pan-African Film Festival, Danny Glover is one of the organizers of the festival.
Okay.
And Danny Glover had to present him his award. And I when I was talking to Roy, because we, as you know, we'd helped organize showings of the film in different parts of the United States, and we're about to put it on tour, by the way. One of the things that I spoke with him about is to ask Danny Glover, when the film premieres in Zimbabwe, would he be willing to come there, and would he be willing to call for the lifting of sanctions? And the reason that I say that is because as we expose the fact that we feel that TransAfrica had no business working with the National Endowment for Democracy, that Africa Action had no business working with the National Endowment for Democracy, just like we feel no one has any, the Congressional Black Caucus shouldn't be working with them as lovers of the Democratic Party, which they are. They shouldn't be working with them. No one should. And the reason that we take that position is because we have gone from COINTELPRO to OINTELPRO. OINTELPRO is overt intelligence. And at this moment in history, the National Endowment for Democracy, created by Reagan in 83, the National Democratic Institute, Madeleine Albright's baby, and all those type of – matter of fact, the United States the Institute of Peace – for the United States Institute for Peace, which is a mechanism of Congress, which funds these organizations, that is the new form of intelligence. And also, I can't forget the Big Bad Wolf, the United States Agency for International Development. They do out in the open what the CIA used to do in the dark. So it's very important that people know that as we're having this conversation right here. And I think that, but it's not too late for TransAfrica to come out and call for the lifting of sanctions, because if President Mugabe and ZANU-PF can feel comfortable with Danny Davis, Congressman Danny Davis in Chicago, who voted for the sanctions initially, now coming out saying that the time has come for sanctions to be lifted. If the Congressional Black Caucus can say that they now would be willing to invite President Mugabe to Washington to hear his side of the story, which they did symbolically last year, then it shows that it's never too late. And one of the things about President Mugabe, if he could pass the Zimbabwe Reconciliatory Policy, which absolved Ian Smith and the Rhodesians and the UDI of the war crimes against our people, if they could say they were willing to forgive Ian Smith and move on, we are sure he'll forgive the Congressional Black Caucus, and we are sure that he'll forgive TransAfrica.
Yeah, they're just minor players in this whole scenario. But it was quite interesting. A few years after 2000, there was a special issue of the Black Scholar that was put out, that comes out of California. Mm-hmm. And in that issue, there was an article by Horace Campbell who admitted that...
What, you got a laundry list today, man?
He admitted in the article,
oh my God,
that the so-called Black Radical Congress largely broke up because of their position on Zimbabwe. That
exactly.
And challenged them. People like Alambre Braith out of New York went in and challenged them at a conference they held. And
yes,
it caused a consternation that the organization pretty much fell apart. But I do recall very distinctively that in 2000, the majority of the people there were totally confused about Zimbabwe. They were totally confused about the developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
And it's interesting that you say that, because there were some people who were trying to bring me to the, what is it called, the World Social Forum in Detroit?
Yeah, in 2010.
When you had it. Matter of fact, you would talk to me about it. And when I was talking to people and I told them, when I gave them my credentials, I felt how uncomfortable they were.
Yeah.
And I think that this is something that we really need to deal with. But going back to your point, I mean, let's deal with Horace Campbell. Now,
yeah.
Horace Campbell wrote a book discrediting the land reclamation program in Zimbabwe from the very beginning. And the interesting thing about it is Horace Campbell, when Dr. Simbi Mubaka was the Zimbabwe ambassador to the United States, who, in addition to having the diplomatic portfolio, he's a very special man. He was President Mugabe's legal advisor during the Lancaster House negotiations. He helped draft Botswana's constitution. And he told me that Horace Campbell used to come to his house and used to bring students from Syracuse to Zimbabwe on a regular basis.
Right.
So he tried to figure out at what point did he develop this indifferent attitude towards President Mugabe and ZANU-PF. But then we found out that President Mugabe's spokesperson, George Charamba, told me that it began dealing with the issue of the Congo. But what happened is one of the main when you hear people, and I think that this is important too, when you hear people discuss Zimbabwe, not just Zimbabwe, but any issue in the world, Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, Eastern Europe, and when people say my contacts on the ground, but they intentionally are vague, they won't tell you who they are, you have to be suspicious. So what happened is Horace Campbell used to say right around this time you were engaging him. If you remember, he would say, my contacts on the ground, and he would never really disclose who they were, and then he would always say, if you're critical of President Mugabe and Zimbabwe, that doesn't make you reactionary or pro-Western. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, about 4 years ago, if you remember when the inclusive government was created, they had this one special ministry, the Ministry of Reconciliation, Unity and Hope, and all three groupings, all three parties were in that ministry. ZANU-PF had a representative, Shangri's faction of MDC had a representative, and Mutambara's faction of MDC had a representative, if you remember.
Yes.
And the representative for Shangri faction of MDC was none other than Sakai Holland, who was the implementation and policy person for the Shangri faction of MDC at the party level. And when she was addressing a group in D.C. at Howard University of mostly MDC people, it was the Zimbabwe desk at the Voice of America, other MDC folks were there. She compared Zimbabwe to Rwanda.
Hmm.
She said Zimbabwe's media methods were draconian. She was just giving these real general and incriminatory overtures. And we were sitting there saying, wow, you're part of the government. So we knew that that they would have a very difficult time making a quantum leap because you can't attack a government that you're a part of.
No.
And so what ended up happening is I asked her, I said, well, how come you're here and the other representatives of your ministry are not here? And are your comments a reflection of all your ministry, because you're supposed to be pushing the position of your ministry, not your party's position. Am I correct? And then she said, as far as her being in the country without the other two representatives of her ministry, she said, you have to take that up with Horace Campbell, because he's the one who invited us here, and I've been working with him for years.
For years.
So the whole time he was giving the impression that he was just an objective critic who felt that everyone else was subjective and everybody else was sentimental. He was working with MDC the whole time. Another, he's very close to Sister Patricia Rodney, the widow of our beloved brother Walter Rodney.
Yes.
If people know Walter Rodney's history, Walter Rodney was seeking military assistance from ZANU-PF, it is said, in the fight in Guyana. As a matter of fact, the Secretary of Information for the party in Zimbabwe, ZANU-PF, my good friend, my comrade, my elder, Dr. Nathan Shamirira, he told me that the current Minister of Information and Publicity for Zimbabwe, Brother Webster Shamu, was teaching Walter Rodney how to handle certain weaponry. Now, I wanted to meet with Patricia Rodney when she was over the Morehouse Department of Public Health at Morehouse University. I wanted her to deal with, develop something around AIDS work, HIV/AIDS work, because of Zimbabwe's incredible work in that area. And she was ready to see me. And literally, when I was on her way to her office, I'm talking about walking up the stairs now,
mm-hmm.
I get a call all of a sudden saying that she can't meet with me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I put, and then I was told that she was at a meeting and he was condemning Zimbabwe, which he usually does when there's no
yeah.
one around.
Right.
And she was nodding her head. She was nodding her head in approval.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there saying that even, and that's when I realized, because this is right around like 2007, 2006, when I was over there, I spent a lot of time, which I mentioned last week, with Dr. David Parinyatua, the son mm-hmm. of Samuel Parinyatua, who's a brilliant doctor in his own right. And he just was explaining to me how the United States and Britain had used their leverage with the Global Fund to deny their applications in the second, third, fourth, and sixth round. And we had put out a resolution saying that humanitarian aid as a weapon is a violation of human rights. And we got some church leaders to sign on to it. We got some medical people to sign on to it, because that's what type of issue it was. And we recognized at that point that certain people who were in education, academic capacities and humanitarian capacities had received a call from the Senate, had received their call from the White House, and the decision makers not to make any humanitarian overtures, not to make any academic overtures towards Zimbabwe. And if you remember, this is right around the same time that Michigan State University and University of Massachusetts Amherst had threatened to rescind the honorary degrees that President Mugabe got from their institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about that is that Michigan State University during the days of Vietnam,
right.
They were one of the main instruments
Trainer.
Used. Yeah, as a matter of fact, an adjunct professor named Wesley Faisal, according to Rampart Magazine, had a bigger villa in South Vietnam than Diem did. And then, of course, they had a Vietnam project. And in terms of University of Mass Amherst, before any students at University of Mass Amherst talk about President Robert Mugabe, you need to change the name of your university. Your university is named after a man who injected our Native American sisters and brothers with smallpox and committed genocide against these people. So how the hell are you talking about President Mugabe's no longer worthy of a degree with your name on it? As a matter of fact, the fact that Amherst's name was on it, President Mugabe was doing you a favor by taking it from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at that commemoration. I believe it was 1991 or 1992 when Mugabe was there, and he was awarded an honorary doctorate degree by Michigan State. And at that time, they were developing close relations between the University of Zimbabwe and Michigan State University.
Right.
And a lot of that changed.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, man, for a long time, when we were trying, like in the early part of this century, to make some bridges, only because, I mean, in addition to the political aspect of it, Zimbabwe has a 97% literacy rate. And historically speaking, the first high school wasn't built for us till 1946 in a place called Gurumunzi. This is 8 years before Brown versus Board. This is in the same historical time frame as what happened in Little Rock with Sister Daisy Bates and those people. So we know that that story of how they were able to develop a 97% literacy rate, we know that will resonate with people who want to preserve our HBCUs. We know that will resonate with people who are dealing with affirmative action. We know that will resonate with people who want to save our African independent schools that we're losing, like Nasaroma right there in Detroit. So we know that that story will resonate with people, and this is the reason that they don't want to deal with Zimbabwe. And that's why I was so happy when I called them, brother, to hear you playing President Mugabe, because I think that what people need to understand is he has an advantage that Raul Castro doesn't have. He has an advantage that Assad doesn't have. He has an advantage that Kim Il-sung's grandson doesn't have. Nothing gets lost in translation when he speaks. That linguistic factor is so important. And as we're sitting here on the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Comrade Maurice Bishop in Grenada, we remember at Hunter College he told us that one of the main reasons he was a threat was not because of the socialist thrust per se,
Right.
Not because of the geographic of the close proximity of Grenada to us, but the fact that when we looked at him, it was like looking in a mirror, and when we communicated with him, an interpreter was not necessary. That's the same
right.
issue with Zimbabwe, and that's the reason why President Mugabe can't go 25 kilometers outside of Manhattan when he comes for United Nations business. And last year, Essex Community College in Newark had invited him. The chair of the African Cultural Center had given the invitation, his blessings, and the president of the university stepped in and said, y'all know I can't do that.
Wow. Amazing.
This is last year.
Amazing.
Last year.
And he gave that great speech where he evoked the assassination, brutal assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. And
ooh.
I thought that was absolutely brave on his part.
And that was ad lib. That wasn't even
yes.
part of the speech. But
exactly.
when we were on the way there, if you see the video of it,
yeah.
he turns his speech around after he says that, and that was the first time in an international setting that he had decided to challenge anything from an intellectual point of view or a political point of view that President Obama has said. He's done President Obama a favor. When President Obama in 2007, as the lowest-ranking senator on the International Relations Committee, wrote Bush a letter, don't lift sanctions on Zimbabwe since the dark cloud of Mugabe's been ousted, he didn't say anything to him. When he refused to let Minister Walter Mzimbe in the White House when the inclusive delegation came to make a statement, flexing his muscle, if you will. No comment from President Mugabe. When the African Leadership Institute that comes to D.C. every year and gets to meet with him comes, and a couple of years ago, he used that platform to say, we hope none of you end up like President Mugabe. President Mugabe didn't say anything. When he went to Southern Africa earlier this year and compared Mandela to George Washington, he might as well have compared King to George Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
He might as well have compared Malcolm to J. Edgar Hoover. He stopped short.
Yeah.
If you're gonna make a foolish statement, be all the way foolish. Don't
exactly.
be, you know, don't, to go all the way with it. But point is, and he used that platform to say, well, we hope Zimbabwe's elections are free and fair. So he'd been taking shots every opportunity that he could. And that was the first time that President Mugabe decided to say, you come here trying to get sympathy for Ambassador Christopher Stevens, yet you're responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of children, women, and men. This is why we tell people, we understand why we stood for Trayvon Martin like we did, but there are a bunch of Trayvon Martins in Libya. There are a bunch of Trayvon Martins in Cuba. There are a bunch of Trayvon Martins in Zimbabwe, children who've died because of sanctions. And so if you're concerned about Trayvon Martin, just like you were concerned about the girls in Birmingham, just like you were concerned with...
It was 50 years ago today that there was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church.
16th Street Baptist Church, exactly.
Four African-Americans.
Cynthia Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and the other girl, beautiful girl.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. When we look at that, the same way we look at Emmett Till or Anna B. Hayes or Bobby Hutton, if you're concerned about them, then these children whose names you don't know, who were dying because of what Obama did in Libya. These kids may not have been going to get Skittles like Trayvon. They might have been going to get some hummus. They might have been going to get some mango juice. And then the next thing you know, a drone takes them away from their mama, takes them away from their daddy. So it was brilliant that President Mugabe used that UN platform to deal with that. And that's why when he comes to the UN, they're very concerned that he's going to use that platform to challenge the United States, to challenge the European Union. And we know what they've done in the United Nations. This is the reason why they try to block Zimbabwe's chairmanship of the Committee for Sustainable Development, try to prevent President Mugabe from speaking at the Food and Agriculture Summit in Rome, why they try to give Zimbabwe least LDC status. Every overture they've tried to the UN has failed, and the crowning achievement was when they tried to get the UN Security Council to impose an additional measure of sanctions 5 years ago, and China and Russia stepped to the plate and said, that ain't happening. So, I mean, you know, they can keep trying what they want to do, but it's not going to work. not going to work. It hasn't worked, and it will not work.
We have about 10 minutes to go. I wanted to talk about the essay you wrote in regard to W.E.B. Du Bois and how his legacy was kind of forgotten at the recently commemorated 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Could you talk about that?
Well, I mean, that's consistent. If we go back and look at the video, how enthusiastic was Roy Wilkins to mention him 50 years ago?
Right.
Who forced him out, and guess what? You know who recruited Roy Wilkins to the NAACP? You know, Du Bois did.
Yes. Yes.
When he was a journalist in Pittsburgh, and no one knew who he was.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, in Julian Mayfield's critique of Harold Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, he brings that up. He said he was in Ghana, and he was sitting there with Du Bois. They lived two doors next to each other in Ghana. And he was Du Bois' designated driver. And so he's driving Du Bois around, and he's just talking about how much he doesn't like Roy Wilkins. And he says Du Bois just puts his hand up. And he says, "Why'd you do that, Doc?" He said, "I recruited him. You reminded me of one of my biggest mistakes. Talking about him like that." So, of course, I mean, and we have to ask ourselves something as a people. We're not going to sit here and talk about the significance of that day because it means different things to different people. It meant it was something. It meant something different to Malcolm. It meant something different to Dr. King. It meant something different to Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a congressman at the time and wasn't even invited to speak right out at a rally that took right outside his office, which is a whole other conversation. But we have to ask ourselves, is one day more important than 70 years worth of work?
Yes.
70 years worth of work. That's what we will talk. That's what W.E.B. Du Bois represents. Front and center of the first five Pan-African Congresses, front and center of the Niagara Movement, front and center of the NAACP, front and center of the Peace and Information Center, front and center of the Council of African Affairs, 21 books, all these articles, all these essays. No library in the world can consume everything he ever wrote on our behalf. And then in addition to the scholastic work, he's got the organizational credentials to back it. His activism is underrated. But 70 years worth of work, clashing with Booker T. Washington, but being humble enough to say neither one of us understood capitalist exploitation. Clashing with Garvey, but humble enough to work with Garvey's two better halves, Amy Jocks Garvey and Amy Ashwood Garvey, on the 5th Pan-African Congress, arguably the most important meeting of the 20th century that Africa's had, which led to the dismantling of settler colonialism on the continent. So this is what Du Bois meant to us, and we will celebrate him the way that Alice Windham and W. Alpheus Hutton and Julian Mayfield and Jim Lacy and all the people who marched. We also had a march in front of the U.S. Embassy in Ghana the same day as the 50th anniversary of the march, which I included in the article. And one of the protest signs eloquently just said this: W.E.B. Du Bois, 20th century prophet. And yes, I said that on the Sunday, and to my Christian sisters and brothers, I ain't trying to be blasphemous. I'm just trying to be historically accurate.
Most definitely, most definitely. Well, that essay opened up a lot of issues related to the legacy of the civil rights movement. And, of course, in 1963, still had the legacy of McCarthyism. And if you listen to Roy Wilkins' comments on that day, August
28, 1963. With a military uniform on?
Yes, he said Du Bois had taken another path. Not defining what the path was. I thought that was quite funny.
Oh, of course. And one more quick thing about that. One of the things I teach my students, Brother Abayomi, because I've been teaching African children history for 23 years now, more than half my life. One of the things I teach my students as a play on the Bible, I say we have to look in modern African history in three categories: BMLK, DMLK, AMLK, before Martin Luther King, during Martin Luther King, and after Martin Luther King. Because there are many Africans that their political calendar starts on January 1st, 1960, and ends on December 31st, 1969. And we need to burn all those calendars. because they do us a disservice. So for those who make it seem that everybody who came before the 1960s, they're not worthy of analysis, they're not worthy of study, they're not worthy of in-depth exploration, nothing could be further from the truth. Because you're saying the hell with Du Bois, the hell with Carter G. Woodson, you're saying the hell with Ella Baker, you're saying the hell with Septima Clark. I mean, all of these people that made impeccable contributions to this struggle, you're saying forget Arturo Schomburg, you're saying forget Kofi, who, as we sit here, this is the 250th anniversary of the first slave uprising in Guyana. We're saying forget all these people. And because we've challenged imperialism in the academic arena and they made a concession, okay, we won't start your history in 1607. You can go back to Africa 10 million years ago. So this is our interpretation of our history. Africa a million years ago, we jumped from that. It's January 1st, 1960, and everything that happened between that time are only mentioned as mere footnotes or selective quotes at certain seminars and conferences when we're talking to people who we feel comfortable telling the truth to, for those who don't feel like telling the truth all the time and don't feel obligated to tell the truth all the time.
Well, in closing, I want you to talk about some of the work you've done in the theater with the play.
Oh, man. Yes, we've real quickly, because, you know, as you promised me, which we'll do at some point, we'll come on and just deal with that.
Right.
I am a founder of a children's history and theater company called Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company. We do not teach history to our children. We teach history through our children. And mass comes from our definition by Frantz Fanon. To educate the masses of the people is to passionately and relentlessly teach them that everything depends on them. We've done 7 plays in 2 years. Our first play was in June of 2011, African Liberation Day for Our Children. Our second play was in February of 2012, Cuba's Greatest Army, a tribute to the Cuban doctors. Our third play was Sally Mugabe Lives Forever. Our fourth play was The War in the Classroom, which was a tribute to different freedom fighters who had a academic and teaching background. We had everybody from Septima Clark to Mangaliso Sobukwe to Julius Nyerere to Marva Collins as part of that effort. Our fifth play was In Remembrance of Kwame Nkrumah and Thomas Sankara. Our sixth play was Same Neighborhood, Different Perspectives, a conversation between General Colin Powell and Kwame Ture. Our seventh play was Maintaining Resistance Behind the Bars. And on November 21st, we're going to do our eighth play. It's called The Giant That Many Overlooked, reintroducing Julian Mayfield.
Wow.
Our play after that will be Why I Chose February, the life of Carter G. Woodson, which we are told is the first children's play ever about him. And then we have another play called The Sisters Who Used Fighting Words, and it's an anthology of different sisters who did writing in some capacity, journalistically, poetically, what have you. Everyone from Phyllis Wheatley to Margaret Walker to Daisy Bates will be in that play. And then we're going to do our first adult play and our only, we'll never do it again, called Gorillas, Mothers, and Wives, about the Eritrean women. And then our last play of this calendar academic year, so to speak, will be We Cannot Let 21st Sports Become 21st Century Slavery. Once a year, the children write a play with us. Last year, this year, earlier, they wrote that play, Maintaining Resistance Behind the Bars, with us. I had a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, and 2 13-year-olds co-author that with me. And I'm going to have about 4 or 5 children that are going to write that sports play with me.
Wow. Well, it sounds very exciting. And it's always an honor to have you on the panel.
It's an honor to be on.
And could you give people information about how they can contact you?
Sure. In terms of organizationally, I just helped start an organization called the Pan-African Collective for Advocacy and Action. So they can contact us through that. They can go to yourworldnews.org to get more information about that. If they want to contact me personally, obiegbuna15@gmail.com. Brother Abayomi has posted up all our writing, so you can find us there. And in terms of if you want to find out more information about the Children's History and Theater Company, you can go to www.massemphasis.com. www.massemphasis.com. So you can find the information on there. If you want all the Zimbabwe writing, you can just go to Google and type in Obi Egbuna on Zimbabwe. I've written about 75 articles since about 2006. And I want to say that Abayomi has published at least 50 of them. At least. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for continuing to write. And of course, it's once again, thank you for coming on the program.
Always a pleasure.
Definitely have you back again in the near future.
Look forward to it. Until then, you keep up the excellent work you do.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
That was Obi Egbuna, the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald. And we're going to be concluding our program for this week. If you want to have access to this program, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network at Blog Talk Radio, and you can share this program with other potential listeners. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week. Was the sound of the Bundu Boys from the Southern African nation of Zimbabwe. And, of course, this is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off. And if you want to have access to this program, just log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, the Pan-African Journal program, and you can share this program with other listeners. Have a beautiful week.